Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth with me, Alex Steger, and today I'm joined, as ever, by Ian Wenick, and not as ever, but as a treat, Andrew Forsch. Ian, Andrew, how are you both doing?
I'm doing well. I mean, this is the first time that all three of us have done this remotely, and so, you know, the vibes are kind of off for me. There's no feng shui. I'm not sitting in my normal spot. You know, it was nice when Andrew was in, so I'm just kind of, this is a big adjustment period for me.
Yeah, no, also we should tell the listener, you know, because starting with visual descriptions is obviously very helpful for an audio format. You are, I imagine you're also nervous, because the police could turn up and make you move your car at any moment. Is that, we're also dealing with that jeopardy.
This is an emergency. This takes priority.
High risk podcasting here.
It really is. High risk, high stakes. So listener, strap in. Jokes aside though, you guys also, as well as obviously we're doing this all remotely, you have been on the road, both of you, this week, down in sunny, I think it was sunny, Miami, for the Future Proof Citywide, not Citywire, conference, correct?
Yes, we both flew back yesterday morning. We got in on Sunday, Andrew earlier than me. I unfortunately had some flight delays and missed Andrew's panel, but he did a great job up there. I think it was his speaking debut at one of these conferences, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's correct. It was great, and they got me to kick off the conference. So I was the first, I was the moderator of the first panel on the first day. So nice to be kind of selected to help kick things off.
Awesome. Well, we'll come on, I think, in a minute to, I think, well, you both hosted panels, and that's probably where we're going to focus. As well as kind of picking up on maybe sort of vibes and, you know, what you learned from the many RIAs and associated folk down there. But I wanted to kick off, Andrew, with a story that obviously you wrote from there, but broadly, it was an interview with Joe Duran, who is, I should have checked this first, CEO, or at least the sort of the head honcho, we could say.
Managing Rise. Partner, I think, is the title. But yes, you'd be correct in assuming he's kind of the top guy.
Top guy at Rise Growth Partners. And he gave you a bit of an insight as to what they're up to and what they'll be doing next. But maybe before we get onto that, let's kick off with some context for those who perhaps don't know who Joe Duran is or what his bona fides are in terms of sort of RIA deal making.
Yeah, can definitely do that. So Joe Duran, I think, is probably best known by our listeners as the founder and longtime kind of chief executive of United Capital Financial Advisors. They were an early RIA aggregator. He was one of the first people to kind of go around the country buying different shops, unifying them together, and growing exponentially, inorganically, and famously sold that business in, I believe it was 2019, to Goldman Sachs, a very big deal.
Story that Ian and I are still not bitter about to this day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted. Continue.
Not at all. No. Yeah, so that was, I believe, a $750 million deal. You know, Goldman held on to that business for just a few years before divesting in 2023, selling
story
that.
Story that we did break. Both of you broke. You guys broke together, yeah.
That's correct. And the ensuing...
The three of us broke.
And the ensuing kind of fallout of advisors departing after being transacted over and over again.
But he had left Goldman before the sale. He sort of stayed around for a certain amount of time and was a partner, but he had gone by that point, hadn't he?
Yeah, he left. I think he was still maybe doing some consulting for them, but formally he had left the business and was not directly affiliated with United Capital. I think it was months before the kind of sale effort really started to heat up. And now he's got a new business, which is called Rise Growth Partners. It's a minority investing vehicle in RIAs. And they've made two deals so far, one of which came in the beginning of 2024. That was Bleakley Financial Group. They were about a $10 billion kind of collection of 1099 advisors. And he's since made one other acquisition of a Massachusetts kind of investment manager called Grimes and Company. And they're a little bit different because they do custom stock picking for clients.
Okay, cool. But the rough idea is he's not trying to do another United Capital. It's a different sort of operation. It's taken a series of minority stakes in firms and not necessarily looking to smash them all together? Or have I got that wrong?
No, that's correct. Yeah, he's doing minority deals. He is kind of advising the deal targets on things that they can do to improve kind of efficient operations, how they can grow better. But technically, those companies don't have to listen to him if they don't want to. I think the idea is that firms that Rise Growth Partners does invest in are looking for Joe Duran and the team's advice. And so Bleakley has taken that advice, and the big news that was unveiled at Future Proof this week. Well, there were a few different pieces of news, but one was Bleakley's hire of former Pershing executive Adam Roosevelt as its chief growth officer. And they also teased that they're going to be rebranding soon. They did not reveal what the new name is going to be, but that is coming too for that company.
Okay, so they're making moves, and already they'd also made some changes prior to these announcements around the organization of the firm, or specifically the advisors within Bleakley and how they would be contracted, which I think is also significant.
Yeah, this is probably the biggest deal. After the investment, Bleakley undertook a really massive campaign to move these advisors from 1099 independent contractor relationships over to become W-2 employees, which, as Duran kind of indicated in our conversation, is not something that advisors are often or always willing or excited to do. So that is a big deal, and the headline numbers are about 80% of assets under management transition to the new W-2 number model, and about 70% of its advisors. I believe there's now about 40 lead advisors, and we Ian and I reported on I believe one or two teams leaving, but it looks like the vast majority of folks actually were convinced to make the move and sell their businesses into the Bleakley platform.
And we spoke on a previous episode, I believe, with Sam. Ian, correct me if I'm wrong, about obviously this, in that instance, it was, help me out here, who was the firm, Ian, who also made this move? Stewart Partners?
Yes, Stewart Partners decided to stop its 1099 recruiting.
Yeah, and but that wasn't, but I guess what they had, didn't do there was transition the existing firms over to the W-2 model. It was just new firms joining, whereas what Bleakley has done is actually move the existing teams over to that model. And as discussed on that previous episode, there's obviously benefits to the business of having your advisors on the W-2 model in terms of stickiness of assets and other such things.
It's definitely much more profitable for the underlying advice business as well, which is kind of why Hightower followed a similar approach when it converted a lot of its advisors into W-2 employees.
Got it. Interesting. Okay. Anything else from Duran in your chat with him, Andrew? He's an interesting guy. He's an influential guy. Did he have anything else to say, either about what he's up to or sort of wider thoughts on the world of RIAs in 2025?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you get to sit down and get kind of FaceTime with Joe Duran is a big deal. And he was pretty eager to kind of talk about just what's on the horizon for him and for Rise Growth. He's got a very clear vision of kind of what he likes and what he's interested in as far as potential deal targets. And so he got into all of that and more. A few points that I can touch on. Yeah, I think the main point was he wants to go into businesses where other investors in RIAs, whether they're private equity firms or other kind of fellow minority investing vehicles, don't want to be. So he's finding RIAs that for some reason or another, haven't kind of been scooped up by these big acquirers or big investors, because he believes that there is a certain amount of opportunity there to be unlocked. And so both of the two companies that he's invested in so far, Bleakley and Grimes, had their own kind of meaningful business differentiator. So Bleakley, he said, is populated by a lot of ex-insurance people who are quite good at sales, and that has resulted in really strong organic growth for that company compared to other kind of traditional planning-led RIAs. And Grimes, the investment manager, does this kind of bespoke stock picking, which kind of sets it apart from other investment managers. And so there are a few other vectors that he pointed out as of being particular interest to him. One of those was geographic kind of concentration in what he called tertiary markets. So non-major cities, especially in the Midwest, there's not a lot of kind of big, fast-growing RIAs that are doing that, and so he's intrigued by that. He also said Rise is in advanced talks with a company that is doing kind of centralized digital-first planning. So think what Ken Fisher has done, but with planning rather than strictly with investment management, and specifically with young clients. He's looking for Gen X, Gen Y type clients. And that's also a difficult market for RIAs to break into, as we know.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's obviously, you know, one could say, well, there's a reason why people are not interested in these smaller cities in, you know, traditionally less wealthy areas, or there's a reason why firms haven't catered to younger clients. And I mean, obviously, those are all around sort of asset size and the sort of legwork you have to put in to try and grow them. But I suppose the counter to that is, well, look, everyone else is fishing in the same pool for, you know, big books of business with big boomer clients. So maybe, you know, try something different. Ian, what are your thoughts as our resident deal czar? How do you view this strategy?
I always have made this comment that I kind of compare Joe Duran almost to Brett Favre, because he succeeded place and place again, and he wants to constantly kind of prove himself. And I will admit that, you know, there was some skepticism around Rise, because it took a decent while for them to make their first deal after Joe took the curtain off. He actually announced the existence of Rise in 23 at the main Future Proof conference in California. We broke that ahead of that conference, obviously. And yeah, it took a little while, but now you really kind of see what he's trying to offer here. I think it's also worth noting that there are a lot of advisors that really love working with someone like Duran and think that he's someone who's going to really help them optimize their business. And so I think that it makes sense that you can, one, say, yeah, we're going to help you with strategy, help you with operations, help you run smoother. And then now he has like a real physical concrete example to point to when he's talking to future prospects. So I am kind of starting to see where his thinking is on this.
Cool. Well, yeah, brilliant. Well, I guess all we could do is, you know, wait and see what the results are over time. But Andrew, thank you. Sounds fascinating, and obviously, you know, good use of your time to be down there and catch up on that. But you guys, that's not the only thing you guys were both doing. You were both, as we've touched on stage at various points. So Andrew, I think we can say kicked it all off. But Ian, were you headlining later? Could we go as far as to say that? And if so, what was your panel on?
So headlining is an extremely generous term. So when they put out the music festival style poster listing all the speakers, I was at the bottom of the bottom in the smallest possible font, basically the opener of all openers. Whereas I think Andrew, you know, he got to kick off, you know, similar to how Major League Baseball team, when they open up new stadiums, guy gets the first hit, guy gets the first home run, they save the stuff and send it to the Hall of Fame. Andrew was the first moderator of the first event at the first edition of this conference. Should have saved something of his, donated it, put it in the RIA Hall of Fame. But
yeah, take anyway. The microphone, right? Put that away. They should have.
Yeah, set the mic aside.
Well, fair enough. All right. But what was the panel on, Ian? So I'm sorry you didn't get your name in lights, and I believe you should have done. But what did you get to talk about? I'm sure you more than made up for your low billing by producing a high wattage display.
Yeah, so the panel that I hosted was about firm value creation versus firm value destruction. And I hosted that with Andy Watts from Avantax and Jonathan Foster from Angelus Wealth Management. Two different types of RIA models. Jonathan, kind of a traditional ultra high net worth RIA business. Avantax, obviously lots of CPA ties, parts of Cetera Financial Group. And so we were up there on stage for about 40 minutes. And I'm not going to lie, I had a very long Bob Vila, this old house, home improvement theme that I weaved across multiple questions, because we talked about, okay, what can you put in that's the actual foundation of the business instead of the ship lab or the barn door in the pantry? And we talked about creating a sustainable strategy for organic growth. We talked about equitizing employees, getting the G2 involved, encouraging people to get in front of centers of influence. And then we also kind of talked about what are the kind of structures that are dangerous. Like, what are the red flags we look at an RIA that's trying to sell? And we went deep into what goes wrong when you center everything around one core producer, one core rainmaker. Here's what goes wrong when you have the key man risk that goes along with it. And also when they kind of hoard the equity. And so we talked about, all right, what are you looking for when someone's forced to sell because they can't fund their succession versus someone looking to find capital, find a partner to grow even faster. And so it was really fun to kind of get into the deep different types of growth, because I think that a lot of times firms really try to hide the secret sauce of organic growth. They think that it's like the elixir to eternal life and they don't want to share with people. But I thought that we had a really good, open, honest conversation. And I also think that we were pretty well attended, but I think that's mostly because we were under shade and people were trying to get out of the heat.
Fair enough. Okay, so you mentioned a couple of the red flags there. Any other ones, you know, beyond obviously sort of, you know, key man risk, or, you know, in terms of producing or holding on to all the equity, any other sort of things that they watch for when doing acquisitions?
Yeah, well, I think another thing that we kind of talked about. So I really try to cite the example of Moneta Group, which is, if you're a listener like my wife who doesn't know who that company is, Moneta Group, one of the biggest RIAs in the country, I think well north of $30 billion in assets at this point, based in St. Louis, one of the few firms that is that big without any kind of private equity backer. And what Moneta does is they rebalance all of the equity every single year to avoid people that get the equity and just kind of become a free rider. And so what Moneta does is they really incentivize you to produce. So if you're producing well, bringing in new business, then yeah, you get more equity. If you're not, then you're forced to sell. And so we kind of talked about what are the incentive structures that you can put into place. And so we talked about using equity as kind of a carrot to incentivize production, as opposed to, again, having it and then people kind of sit without any real future stake in the business.
Got it. They is, as potential acquirers, they like to see, you know, intelligent incentive structures that, you know, keep people hungry and keep organic growth moving. Fantastic. And Andrew, we've joked about your panel. What was it actually on? And I guess what were the sort of biggest takeaways that you took from it?
Yeah, I you know, with these kind of panels, you don't often get to sort of choose what your topic is going to be. So it's sort of just luck of the draw. And I was actually really happy with what I got, because it was topical, it was timely. There's a lot of kind of interesting stuff going on in this area in recent weeks, which is the convergence of public and private markets. So all kinds of sort of creative and interesting new fund vehicles or wrappers coming out. And I had two really great panelists on stage with me. That was Stephen Tookwood of Modern Wealth Management, another ex United Capital shop that it wasn't technically ex United Capital, but it was formed by ex United Capital executives. Stephen Tookwood himself runs the investment desk. He's ex Goldman Sachs, really, really smart guy. And then Shayna Sissel of Bannerine Capital, Capital Management, that's her shop. And so, yeah, the topic was basically, what do you think of all of these new vehicles? What does it mean for advisors? And what does it mean for clients who might be kind of demanding, you know, in some cases, better performance from their fixed income side of the portfolio, that sort of thing.
The new story here, or the most the sharpest point of this tip is the launch in the last few weeks of the State Street, it was called sort of the State Street Apollo Private Credit ETF, and now for various reasons, the word Apollo is no longer being used in the name after the SEC sort of belatedly flagged some concerns. We're not going to get into all of that now, but obviously that particular fund is a sort of, you know, kind of the zenith of a wider and longer term trend for, as you say, firms trying to offer private market type strategies, but to a more wealthy, even retail-y investor base than has previously been the case, as discussed. And as listeners will know, obviously that's previously sort of been targeted at more institutional investors. And yeah, putting it in an ETF is really sort of the most retail thing you could just about do. But I think ever since that fund was first filed for with the SEC, there have been people raising a decent number of questions about how that's going to work, and the obvious, at least on paper, liquidity mismatch between an ETF that can trade daily and a portion of its underlying holdings that one would think couldn't do the same. And I imagine that was something you guys got into.
Yeah, there's two sides, right? On one hand, there is genuine kind of excitement here. This is a big deal. You've got a semi-private product trading daily, you know, that you can buy and sell every day, which is new and exciting and I'm not ready to say that it's good just yet. I mean, I think that kind of remains to be seen. But yeah, Shayna made some really great comments, just sort of expressing skepticism about how this is all going to work. I mean, Apollo is sort of promising that it will provide all of the liquidity for this, but yeah, there is inherent risk with that as well. You can't just close an ETF. So what happens if there's a run on this stuff? And Shayna kind of invokes the idea of being too big to fail and how that may, you know, in a kind of extreme scenario, might not apply in this world, even to a firm like Apollo, which is about as big as it gets in the private asset management world. So, you know, there's definitely kind of trepidation and apprehension with this. But it's interesting and it's new and it's exciting. And that's kind of that's kind of the sense that you get around a lot of these products is, you know, even with things like interval funds, things like tender offer funds. I mean, all of this is new, but it's a little bit less transparent. It's less liquid. And so firms are just kind of learning how to mix all of this in to a client portfolio and where it really belongs and at what level, for example, like the liquidity premium is actually worth the risk with some of these things. And so that's a conversation that investment desk heads are having more and more often than ever.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because it's sort of such a sort of big trend, but it's still very much early days in terms of, you know, how RIAs are using these, particularly where firms haven't offered them before, and to your point, where they fit in client portfolios. Well, look, guys, this has been fantastic. We're in danger of running over our normal amount of time. I wanted very quickly to ask you two things. So first of all, any other kind of vibes or sort of tips from your time at Future Proof that you sort of picked up on sort of what the RIA community is thinking or doing at the moment? Anything you wanted to share there beyond what was sort of said on stage?
I definitely felt a sense of almost unease, I think, about where the markets stand. And this is something we talked about before, but I think that a lot of these big aggregators are very highly levered. And I think there's definitely some trepidation from some of the sources that I spoke to on site about what's going to happen if we have a real market downturn that lasts more than a quarter or two. So it was fun. I definitely felt at times that there was a little bit subdued, I think, just based on that kind of, we talked about vibes. They were not the best vibes at times.
No, that's really interesting. I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously, markets have been very choppy. And to your point, yeah, there's some businesses that really, I mean, obviously, all wealth firms would rather see things go up than down, but it will hurt some more than others for sure. Okay, that's one thing. And then the other thing I wanted to end on, Ian, was you in your car today, because you're actually off today, and you very kindly taking some time out to record this, because it is the start of something that I still don't understand after 9 years in the United States, March Madness.
This is correct. It's my favorite day of the year, first day of the tournament. So 16 games today, another 16 tomorrow in the round of 64. The best two sports days on the calendar. And no Penn
How
this year.
many games do you feel you get? How many games do you get in a day during
Oh, I
March
watch part
Madness?
of every single game.
Part of every single game. Okay. And I don't want the whole bracket, but if you had to put one or two firms. God, I spend too much time doing work, don't I? One or two teams in the mix to get to go far in the tournament. Dare I say, win it? Who are your tips?
Duke is my call. Not only both, that's both emotional. My wife is a Duke alum, big Duke fan. She had a stressful time watching Duke play UNC a couple weeks ago. But yeah, I genuinely think the Duke's going to win it all this year. And I also think that the Ivy League champions, Yale, are going to make some noise this year as well. They're a very, very, very solid team. And I always cheer for the Ivy League champion, even if it's a team like Princeton that I hate 99% of the time.
Excellent. Well, look, on that somewhat positive note, I think we're called time on this. But look, thank you both very much indeed for joining from various states across the country, and thank you very much for you know, heading off down to Miami and making the trip this week and bringing us back all this news. So look forward to seeing you both next week. But otherwise, that's it for another episode of This Week in Wealth.